The way IPOs are priced is sort of like an exclusive nightclub, where if you want to know what nightclub is good, they've got a long line of people out the door, many of whom will never get in. And so when you price an IPO, you want to price it at, let's say, $30 a share, and you want to you're selling 7 million shares. You want to have 70 million shares of demand at $30 a share. You want to have 10x the demand. And if you have 10x the demand, it means the price is going to skyrocket. So that's just the way they price IPOs, the same way that's the way you run a nightclub.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of The Backbone, a podcast exploring the journey of finance and operations within tech companies. I'm your host, Shubham Datta, at Shubham on Twitter. If this is your first episode, welcome, and thanks for checking it out. For those returning listeners, I'm so glad you're here. I hope that you've subscribed, rated, and reviewed the show on whichever platform you're hearing this now. It would mean so much to me and help spread the stories of these amazing finance leaders we feature on The Backbone.
Joining me on this episode of The Backbone is Jeff Epstein, an operating partner at Bessemer Venture Partners in the Silicon Valley office, where he leads Bessemer's CFO advisory board and helps portfolio company CEOs and CFOs share best practices. He is the former executive vice president and chief financial officer of Oracle, one of the world's largest and most profitable technology companies, with a market value of over $150 billion. Prior to joining Oracle, Jeff served as a CFO of several public and private companies, including DoubleClick, sold to Google, King World Productions, sold to CBS, and Nielsen's Media Measurement and Information Group. Earlier in his career, he was an investment banker at the First Boston Corporation. He specializes in B2B software, marketplaces, and artificial intelligence software. Jeff is also the co-CEO and CFO of Apex Technology Acquisition Corp, a SPAC, which has announced a merger with AvePoint. Jeff serves on the board of directors of Kaiser Permanente, Twilio, Poshmark, Shutterstock, and several private companies. Jeff served on the board of directors of Booking Holdings / Priceline for 16 years, as its market value grew from $1 billion to $80 billion. He holds an MBA from the Stanford University Graduate School of Business, where he was an R.J. Miller Scholar, and a BA from Yale College. And so without further ado, here's Jeff Epstein. Thanks so much for joining me this afternoon. It's a pleasure to have you on The Backbone. Before we get started, how are you doing, Jeff?
I'm doing very well, and thank you for inviting me.
Awesome. Well, we've got lots to get through today, so why don't we start first by talking a bit about your career journey. You started your career as an investment banker, and from there, you moved into tech and media, first as a CFO of King World Productions, and then with stops at DoubleClick, which is now owned by Google, Nielsen, and your last operating gig as the executive vice president and CFO of Oracle. Since then, you've joined the investing side as an operating partner with Bessemer Venture Partners, and you sit on the boards of Kaiser Permanente, Twilio, and Shutterstock, to name a few. There's a lot to unpack, so let's start at the beginning. Talk to me about your first operating gig and how your career transformed from being a finance operator to joining the investment side.
Terrific. Well, going way back 40 years when I got out of business school, I started as a consultant at the Boston Consulting Group, then went with one of the partners at BCG with the Washington Post Company, which had newspapers, magazines, TV stations, cable television. And at BCG, my view was I didn't know really what I wanted to specialize in and focus on, but consulting was great training. BCG was just a terrific place to work. And I got to work on a dozen different cases with different clients in different industries and get a broad exposure. It was almost like postgraduate school. And one of my clients was in the media industry, and I liked watching television and reading newspapers. So I said, this is fun. Maybe I can work in this area. And then when the BCG partner went to the Washington Post, he brought me along as head of business development. And we looked at strategy, acquisitions, and growing the business there. And the Washington Post was not too far after Watergate, with Ben Bradley was still the editor of the newspaper, and Kay Graham was the chairman of the company. It was just an extraordinary place to be. Warren Buffett was on the board of directors. I got a chance to meet him and present to the board. So pretty special experience.
That's very cool.
And then as the in the mid-80s, when the market was growing quickly, I was recruited to join an investment bank to specialize in media mergers and acquisitions. And the choice there was, do I stay working for a company in middle management, or could I get more senior leverage by going back to a professional services firm? And the interesting thing, both at BCG and at First Boston, is you can be a young banker or a young consultant, and you're in the room with the CEO of the client. You're not necessarily the person with the close relationship, but you're there. Whereas if you work for the CEO, you're probably five levels down, and you don't get a chance to see the CEO nearly as much if you're an insider compared to being an outsider. So I liked that idea. And I saw Wall Street was growing, and there was a lot of media mergers and acquisitions going on. I ended up working for Bruce Wasserstein and Joe Perella, two of the greatest M&A bankers of their generation. Learned a lot about banking and loved working there. But my heart was still in running businesses. And one of my clients was King World, as you mentioned, which distributed Wheel of Fortune, Jeopardy, and Oprah Winfrey. So a small company with three giant profitable hit shows. New York Stock Exchange, they had an accounting CFO and they wanted a Wall Street CFO. And so they invited me to join. And that was my first CFO role when I was 32 years old. It was just a great opportunity for me. And looking back, that when you're not a public company CFO and then you become a public company CFO, that it's getting your ticket to the big leagues, basically, in a way. And once you have that ticket, then every other time there was a public company CFO search, I'd be on the list. So that transition was probably the single most important opportunity for me that I took advantage of and loved it.
From there, that first ticket that you mentioned, that got you into some other high-profile technology companies thereafter as well. Right after King World, you transitioned to DoubleClick, which at the time was its own entity, but later was acquired by Google. And then you went on to Nielsen, and then the CFO at Oracle, which was your last operating gig. How did those transitions happen, and what was that experience like?
None of this was planned, but in hindsight, when I look at the pattern, there were four things that I was looking for. One is the most important thing was to work with great people who I admired, and usually those people working at great companies. So that was an important part of what I looked for. I also was thinking about functional expertise. I was thinking about industry expertise. And then I was thinking about size, company size. So in terms of functional expertise, I was a generalist coming out of business school and then learning about investment banking, specializing in finance, and then joining King World, I became a CFO and spent the next 25 years as a CFO. So the functional expertise was broadly finance and then more narrowly the CFO role. And then industry, Warren Buffett, who once I had met him, I read everything I could by him and about him. And he liked to say that he always wanted to invest within his circle of competence, which requires two things. It requires that you have a circle of competence and that what the limits of that circle of competence is. And you start off, you don't have a circle of competence. Over time, you develop experience and you learn about things. So over a number of years, I learned a lot about the media industry, about newspapers, magazines, TV stations, felt pretty comfortable in that market and felt that was an area, that industry specialization was a circle of competence for me, both at the Washington Post Company, at First Boston, doing media mergers and acquisitions, and then at King World, which was a television programming company supported by advertising. And then when I had the opportunity, King World, I was the CFO there for 6 years, it went very well, the market value tripled. And then when the internet was just starting up, it seemed clear to me that once it was easy to deliver information electronically, you were no longer going to have cut down trees, convert it into paper, take the paper to a printing plant, print newspapers, drive the print newspapers around to everyone's home. It just seemed that was a pretty high cost way of delivering news compared to what we have today on our iPads. It was still pretty early, but if you think about the transition from print to radio, radio to TV, TV to the internet, it's if you spend some time in these industries, it's pretty clear what's happening. So in 1998, which was very early on in the internet advertising world, the first internet ad ran in 1995. And DoubleClick, the largest internet advertising technology company, had $25 million of revenue. When I joined, I was the 180th employee. And they were looking for a CFO who had public company experience, who was either came out of the media industry or the technology industry, because we were both half a media, half a technology company. So I check public company experience. I checked media, did not check technology, but was lucky enough to get hired there. And it was an incredible time because it was during the internet boom. We grew from 180 employees to over 2,000 employees in 3 years. The stock market valuation went from $250 million to over $11 billion during that time, and pretty extraordinary. Then the whole market crashed. NASDAQ crashed. Half our customers went out of business. We ended up shrinking from 2,000 to about 1,000 people. Our revenue shrank from $500 million to $250 million. Really tough time. The nuclear winter of the internet in general and internet advertising in particular. But we had raised a lot of money at the top of the market. That was something I was very proud of, that we were able to do that. So we had plenty of capital. And we still had the leading position in an important marketplace. And ultimately, Google acquired the company. And today, DoubleClick is the foundation of Google's display advertising business. It's a very important part of Google. And at that point, when the business market was still not doing very well, I wanted to go to a more established company. And back to the question of functional specialty, which was CFO, industry specialty, which was initially media, but now media and technology, because DoubleClick was a technology company. I was still a mid-sized company, because DoubleClick, in the hundreds of millions of revenue, was not billions of revenue. And I wanted to get that multi-billion dollar revenue experience. And I was fortunate enough to get hired by Nielsen. I became the divisional CFO of Nielsen, not the parent company CFO, of the media and measurement information division. So it was Nielsen television ratings. They had information about entertainment, movies, and movie theaters, and Nielsen net ratings, which was the internet ratings business, which was a separate public company that we controlled. So got big company experience in a multi-billion dollar environment, operating in dozens of countries around the world, almost 10,000 employees. And that was just terrific experience for me to learn about the internal operations of how to run a company at scale. And then when I ended up moving back out to Silicon Valley, where I had lived at Stanford, and became a CFO at Oracle, which is even bigger, $30+ billion in revenue. Today, it's almost $200 billion in market value, about $150 billion when I was there. There were 130,000 employees, over 6,000 of them just reported to me as wow. The CFO. So we had a big organization. And what you do when you start off in your career, you're an individual contributor, you do 100%, you delegate nothing. When I was the CFO of DoubleClick, I started out with, I guess it was about 9 people in my department. And I was probably doing 25% of the work and delegating 75%. And at Oracle, you do basically, you know, 0 to 1% of the work and delegate 99% of the work. And that's what leadership's all about. It's figure out the strategy, figure out what needs to be done, and then recruiting and training and supporting the team that does all the work and making sure they're positioned to succeed. And we had just a fantastic team of people at Oracle. It's extremely one of the best execution machines in the world, 40% profit margins, very efficient and effective.
Totally.
And then I retired from full-time CFO work about 10 years ago. And I'm not an investing partner at Bessemer, I'm an operating partner. So I get involved after we make our investments. I can co-invest my own money alongside Bessemer in many cases. And I help the CEOs and CFOs of our companies build their businesses. We often invest in a company with about $5 million in revenue that's growing very fast. It's doubling or tripling. And we grow till it's maybe $100 million in revenue, and then it can go public or potentially get acquired. And that transition from $5 million to 10 to 20 to 50 to $100 million in revenue, there's a lot of lessons learned there. And we have a group of about 100 CFOs at Bessemer who are all pretty alone at their portfolio, at their own portfolio company. But across our portfolio, they can all help each other out. And I help facilitate that peer group learning.
We'll touch a bit about that a little later. But one of the other roles, along with your role at Bessemer, you're the co-CEO and CFO at Apex Technology Acquisition Corp, which is a SPAC, that recently announced that it's merging with AvePoint Inc., which is the largest data management solutions provider for Microsoft Cloud. So a couple of things here that I wanted to chat with you about. Number one, SPACs. So maybe to set the stage, SPACs have been getting a lot of media and press coverage recently. Can you explain to us what a SPAC is, just so we can kind of set the stage before we go deeper?
Yes, a SPAC is a public company with money and no business looking to merge with a private company. And once the merger happens, the private company becomes the public company. An interesting feature of the SPAC is that even though we actually have money, each individual shareholder who gave us that money has the right to get their money back, either when we close the day we close the deal or at the end of 2 years from the time we raised it. So it's, we have the money, but it's not ours to invest. We have to go back to the shareholders and get their approval. And the way that works is SPACs trade at $10 a share when they go public. That's the convention. And if the stock is trading at $11 a share or higher, every individual shareholder will say, that's great. I don't want my $10 back because if I want to sell, I'll just sell in the open market for $11. So the key is on the day of the closing, is your stock trading at above, let's say $10.50 a share? If it is, the deal's going to go ahead. If it's not, the deal's probably not going to go ahead.
Interesting. So I want to double click on that. And so when you say the day of the closing, because I know there's a couple of different milestones and markers that come into play. There's one, which is the deal announcement date. And that's not the same as when the deal is actually closed and the private company is now officially merged. Which of those dates are you talking about that it needs to cross that $10.50
threshold? The day before the closing, the last date.
Okay.
So I'll walk you through the chronology. It starts off, my partner and I went out on a roadshow. We met with a number of investors and we raised $350 million. So they wired us $350 million cash that's sitting in a bank or in treasury bills. And we then go out and look for a company to merge with. We have 2 years to do that. When we find the company, we sign a non-binding letter of intent with that company. And then what's typically happening today is we raise a PIPE, a private investment in a public entity. And we go out, meet with private investors and say, here's this great company. It's very attractive. It's in the process of going public. You can buy shares in this company for $10 a share. You don't actually give us the money today. You give us the money at the closing, but you're signing a contract, an irrevocable contract to give us the money at closing. The people who invested in the initial public offering, they were investing in a blind pool. They don't know what we're going to do, but they're not taking any risk because they're giving us their money, but the worst case is they get their money back 2 years from now. So there's a scenario where they can't lose money. And if the company does really well, they can make a lot of money. So it's a pretty good deal for the IPO investors. The PIPE investors are taking risk, but they know the company. They meet the company, they look at the financials, they can look at the forecasts. And if they like the company, they're just buying in at what they perceive to be a bargain price because they're buying at $10 a share when we all think the stock's going to trade at 11 or 12. Then once you get the PIPE signed up, you announce the deal. Mm-hmm. You then file an S-4 merger proxy with the SEC. The SEC reviews it, comments on it. Once they've approved it, you have a shareholder vote. All of that takes several months. So there's typically 3 months from the time of the announcement to the closing. And then the day before the closing is a shareholder vote and the redemption date. And that's right. When the initial, our shareholders have the right to get their $10 back. And as I said, if the stock's at $11 or higher, doesn't make any sense for people to get $10 back when they could just sell in the open market for 11. And so we are with the merged company we're merging with is called AvePoint. We've announced that deal. We're on file with the SEC. And we expect to close as soon as the SEC approves the merger proxy, we'll distribute the merger proxy. We have then 10 business days for people to look at the proxy, and then we'll have a shareholder vote and a redemption right and close.
Yeah. Well, it's fascinating. And there's so much that goes on kind of behind the scenes. And so appreciate you sharing some color there. I want to maybe talk a bit about the process of raising a SPAC itself. So you talked about you and your investment partner going out and raising $350 million. How does that compare to raising a venture fund, for example? And what are some of the similarities and differences in that process?
Raising a SPAC is much easier. 500 different sponsor groups have raised SPACs in the last couple of years. And the reason it's easier is the investors are taking no risk. The worst case is their money is tied up for 2 years, but then they get their money back plus interest. So whereas in a venture firm, obviously you can lose all your money. So it's a very, investing in a SPAC at the IPO is a very attractive risk reward ratio because you have upside and you have no downside. So, and $100 billion worth of investments have gone into that category in the last couple of years.
That makes sense. And then I guess now turning to the other side of the process of finding the investment in AvePoint, and how does that compare to when you're looking to deploy capital out of a venture fund? Obviously, they're a different profile of investment, like you're looking to deploy in one single company. So there's a certain scale that you've got to meet. But apart from that, what's the process like of sourcing an investment for a SPAC?
Well, there's two parts to that. The first part is like a venture capital or private equity investor or public equity investor, We're looking for high quality companies that we think will be more valuable over time. The difference is we're looking for a private company that wants to be public and is using the SPAC as a means to an end. By merging with the SPAC, they become public. And so there are plenty of private companies that want to stay private, so they're not candidates. And there are other private companies that want to do an IPO or a direct listing, and so they're not candidates. You have to find a company that's private, that wants to be public, that thinks this SPAC process is a good process. And what many private companies are doing today is they're doing a dual process. So they're hiring bankers and saying, I'm private, I want to be public. There are advantages and disadvantages of an IPO versus a merger with a SPAC. Let's go down both paths at the same time until we have specific offers, and then we'll pick one path over the other. So in the case of AvePoint, which is a very attractive data management company, it's got $190 million of ARR forecasted for this year. It's got 25% of the Fortune 500 are customers. It's a leading partner of Microsoft in data management. It's an important growing category. They hired Goldman Sachs to be their banker, and they asked Goldman to do a dual process and say, what would an IPO look like? What would a merger with a SPAC look like? They talked to many SPACs. They liked Brad and me, Lucas, our experience in technology. They picked us. Then they compared merging with us compared to an IPO, and they picked merging with us because they wanted Brad and my involvement. And I think we've been very helpful to them in helping them build the business. I'll join the board. And after the deal closes, the company has grown organically. It's been growing 30% a year, but has never made any acquisitions. Brad and I have a lot of experience in acquisitions, and I think we could help AvePoint grow through acquisitions post-closing.
That makes sense. You started to touch on some of these already, so it's a good segue into the next question I was going to ask. If a company today is thinking about going public, like you mentioned, there's a variety of options available. There's a traditional IPO, there's a direct listing, and now there's also the SPAC. And so how should companies think through which method is the right path for them, and especially someone in a CFO or finance leader seat, how should they be weighing all the various options that are available?
Well, the direct listing is an area which is very interesting, but only about a half a dozen companies have done it, and they're very large. They're typically over $10 billion in market value. So the companies that we're talking to, which are in the billion to $5 billion market value range, really aren't seriously considering a direct listing. In our size range, it's typically an IPO versus a merger with a SPAC. And the trade-offs are, if you want to give forecasts, in 1995, Congress passed a law, the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act, which gave a safe harbor to companies giving good faith forecasts and said, if you give a good faith forecast and it doesn't come true, you won't be liable. That does not apply to IPOs. So you'll know that in IPOs, people don't give forecasts because they don't want the liability, and investment banks don't want the liability. So if you have a business where having forecasts is over the next 3, 4, 5 years is very helpful, which all these mobility companies and additive manufacturing companies, which have very low revenue today, but hope to have a lot of revenue in the future, giving forecasts is a pretty important part of the story. So they really don't have an option to do an IPO because they need to be able to give forecasts, which is why they've chosen SPACs. So giving forecasts is an important reason to merge with a SPAC. Secondly, the partnership with a sponsor is very important. So if you're a venture-backed company or private equity-backed company and you go to Fidelity and say, please buy our stock, we're going public, the person at Fidelity is going to say, wait, look at all these smart people on the board, these venture firms and private equity firms. They're selling. Why are they selling and I'm buying? Wait, that doesn't make much sense. So because Brad and I are coming in and we're coming in the same time the new investors are coming in, and we're, for instance, in our case, we're locking up for a year for half our stock and 2 years for the other half of our stock. The buy side feels pretty confident that we've done our due diligence and they're sitting on the same side of the table as we are. So there are many companies with high quality sponsors where the sponsor can help A, tell the story, and B, endorse the company because they've done the due diligence. We did very detailed due diligence on AvePoint. And finally, you know, we're, as a board member and Brad as an advisor going forward for the next several years, we'll be very involved in helping the company grow. And so that's not available typically in an IPO.
In the IPO path, there's always this pricing conversation, right? Like the day one pop and then, oh, management left X amount of millions of dollars on the table. Is that ever a consideration to, like, pricing? It might be more controllable via a SPAC versus an IPO. Is that a part of the calculus or not really?
It is. And the way IPOs are priced is sort of like an exclusive nightclub, where if you want to know what nightclub is good, they've got a long line of people out the door, many of whom will never get in. And so when you price an IPO, you want to price it at, let's say, $30 a share, and you want to you're selling 7 million shares. You want to have 70 million shares of demand at $30 a share. You want to have 10x the demand. And if you have 10x the demand, it means the price is going to skyrocket. So that's just the way they price IPOs, the same way that's the way you run a nightclub. It's probably not the optimal thing for the company, because you've then sold stock very inexpensively. And the buy side is you're giving a gift of hundreds of millions of dollars. There are companies, for instance, that went public at $2.5 billion market cap that day one traded at $5 billion, and ever since then have been trading at $5 billion, and they gave away, and they sold $1 billion worth of stock for $500 million. So they gave away $500 million of value to the buy side. In a SPAC, because you have a private filing before the public announcement, you can do a private roadshow with these PIPE investors and you start high. So it's more like when you're selling your house, you say, yeah, I think my house is worth $1 million. And if no one buys it, you say, okay, I'll go down to 950 and then 900. And then now you get three people at 900. But you don't want to price the house at $1 million and get 10 buyers and sell it to the first person who comes along at $1 million and have someone turn around and sell it the next day for $2 million. You'd feel like you really were not optimizing your real estate there. So yeah. By coming up with a proposed price in the PIPE process, and if you clear the market, that's great. If it looks like it's a little high, you just say, okay, it was a little high, we'll lower the price a little until the PIPE investors are interested. You can calibrate it much more closely. Once you have a PIPE investor endorsing the price, then you announce, and then you have confidence that that's the right price because the PIPE investor signed a contract to buy at that price.
I really like the nightclub analogy. It really helps to understand the differences there. So that makes a lot of sense. Coming back to what you talked about, part of your role at Bessemer, you lead Bessemer's CFO advisory board and help portfolio companies, CEOs and CFOs share best practices amongst the Bessemer portfolio. Having been a finance leader yourself before, what are some of the unique opportunities and challenges that finance leaders face today? And what is your advice to help them navigate through that?
Well, the typical questions that come up are, should I grow faster and lose more money? Or should I grow slower and make more money? So there's always the trade-off of growth versus profitability. And where you are on that curve depends on how easy it is to sell, what your CAC payback is. If you, for every dollar you invest in sales and marketing, for instance, do you have a fast payback or a slow payback? How are the capital markets rewarding growth versus profitability? How much capital do you have? How big is your market? And so we help CEOs and CFOs and boards think through that question. When to raise money? Do I raise more money now? Do I wait 6 months or a year, raise more money later? What about acquisitions? Should I grow organically or grow through acquisitions or both? If I have a single product in the US, do I add a second product in the US, or do I expand my first product in Europe, or do I try to do both at the same time? How do I allocate resources there? How do I build my team? If I've got 100 people in my company and I've got 5 people in finance, and I'm going to grow to 300 people in the next couple of years, and I'm going to add another 5 or 10 people in finance, do I build up the accounting team? Do I build up FP&A? What about business analytics? How do I do that? What about financial systems and software and services? If I'm on QuickBooks, when do I adopt Sage Intacct as my next product? When do I go to Adaptive Insights, both of which were Bessemer companies? When do I buy Vendor, which is a great product where I'm on the board? Vendor is a service which helps you save money on all your cloud purchasing. So if you have 50, 100, 200 different cloud software contracts at your company, it's typically a pretty big cost center for you. After payroll, it might be the biggest cost center you have, and Vendor can help you save money when you renegotiate your contracts. So just helping people do it more effectively and efficiently.
That's really cool. A lot of interesting opportunities and challenges, and definitely no boring or dull day in the life of a CFO these days. But what I want to do next is jump into our quickfire round. The way this works is I'll ask you a few questions. You'll have 10 to 15 seconds to respond to each. How does that sound?
Okay.
All right. What's your go-to online resource for all things finance related?
CFO Thought Leader, another interviews with CFOs. They've done hundreds of them. Jack Sweeney does a great job doing that.
I've checked out some of those episodes and they're great. Good resource. What's your favorite productivity hack?
inbox zero. I try to get through all my emails by the end of the night before I go to sleep, and it just makes life easier the next day.
Yeah. Always an aspirational state for me, but very rarely does it actually happen. Do you use any specific tools to do that, or just your email client?
Well, when an email comes in, if I can respond right away, I just try to respond literally as soon as I can. When I'm reading it, I try to respond right then. If I need to read it later, I have another folder that it's called Sunday, and I typically go through all the things on Sunday. It takes a little while to read a document or something like that. And then I have a waiting for response email folder in Outlook, where if I send an email out and I expect a response but don't know what it's going to be, I just put it in that folder and then don't look at it. And every Sunday I might go through that and see, well, who hasn't responded to me over the last week or two, I'm expecting something from, and then I'll send a reminder.
Makes sense. What's one thing you don't leave your home office before finishing?
Leave my home office before finishing. Well, there's nothing else I can think of besides email at the end of the night.
Just trying to get closer to, or if not already accomplished, inbox zero. Yeah. What's one jargon that makes you cringe?
Space. This is an interesting, I'm in the cloud software space. I just don't understand, why don't they just say cloud software market? There's a perfect word called market.
It's funny you mentioned that. So if someone is evaluating companies in the space market, do they say that they are evaluating these? Yeah.
Good point.
Yeah. So anyways, no, that's a good one. And lastly, what's the best advice you've received so far in your career?
Try to be helpful. It's not too hard to do that. And whenever it's easier to do when you're older and you have more experience, but whenever I meet someone, I try to figure out what they're trying to accomplish. I try to listen. And at this point, I've met a lot of people, and I know I have resources. I've read a lot. And so I often, something in my background, I might be able to be helpful to someone. And if I can help them now without expecting anything back, it's fun. I enjoy it. And sometimes it turns out to be helpful for me as well.
Well, I definitely think this conversation will be super helpful to many of our listeners and many CFOs and finance leaders who are contemplating a lot of the opportunities and decisions that you talked about, covering your experiences as an operator, as well as now on the investing side, and continuing to help CFOs and CEOs in your roles today. Talking to us about SPACs and the opportunities that affords to companies thinking about going public and how it compares to the traditional IPO process. I definitely learned a lot through that, and I'm sure many of our listeners will as well. So this has been an amazing conversation, Jeff, and thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. Can I ask your listeners for a favor from them?
Of course. Go for it.
Bessemer Venture Partners loves to invest in high growth technology companies and healthcare companies. So if you have any great companies that are raising money that you think you personally would invest in, please let us know. Jeff@bvp.com.
There you go. Perfect. I love it. Well, Jeff, thanks so much for the time. Appreciate it.
Great. Thank you.
Take care. Bye.
Bye.
And that wraps up another episode of The Backbone. Check out some of the other awesome finance leaders featured on The Backbone from companies like Ecobee, Wealthsimple, League, and many more. Thank you for listening all the way through and joining me on this journey inside finance at a tech company. Until next time, take care.